It's Thursday, September 9th, and if people near you aren't vaccinated, don't get in a car accident, I guess. We start here. A year after the field hospitals closed up, some states are begging for reinforcements.
We simply don't have enough people. We don't have the manpower to take care of these patients who keep coming in.
President Biden is about to outline his new strategy for combating COVID. Dr. Ashish Jha is here to tell us what to expect. 20 years later, key documents about 9/11 have remained classified until now.
It just goes to show you that we were right all along.
Victims' families have been pushing for years. We're going to talk to one of them. And it's enough to make some observers' blood boil.
On the one hand, there's the investor fraud. And on the other hand, it's the misleading of doctors and patients.
The Elizabeth Holmes trial is underway, and our team is there to drop in. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Right now in Idaho, there are so many COVID patients in hospitals that in some cases, state officials have activated what they call crisis care.
Nurses are leaving because they're burned out, and we simply don't have enough people. We don't have the manpower to take care of these patients who keep coming in.
This is when doctors have to start rationing equipment and care in whatever way they see fit. That means someone who calls 911 might literally be told to wait while EMS responds to other calls. A patient might show up to the hospital and be sent to lie down, not in a bed, but a conference room. And someone who might normally be assigned a ventilator might not get it because it's been assigned to someone with a better chance of surviving. These were the nightmare decisions that we were envisioning last year. Well, in Idaho, they're in effect now. In fact, yesterday, the U.S. military was called in to help.
The state has identified a number of resources to help us begin to close the gap. The first to arrive is a 20-member medical response team from the Department of Defense.
And this could be on the horizon in multiple states. So let's start the day with Dr. Ashish Jha. He's the head of the Brown University School of Public Health. And Dr. Jha, can you just put in context how big this surge is and what worries you the most about it right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me back. I mean, these surges are unprecedented. In many, many states, they're worse than they were over the winter.
One in four cases in children. And that new variant, the Mu variant, now reported in at least 28 states.
And of course, that was when we didn't have vaccines. We didn't really have any way to protect people. And so we're seeing this crisis level of care that I think borders on a nightmare.
I would encourage all of us to just be a little more careful. Wear your seatbelt. Take medications as prescribed. Reconsider high-risk activities that could land you in the hospital, as that's where we are in terms of hospital capacity at this point.
The idea that we wouldn't be able to provide care for somebody who was critically ill because we didn't have the staffing or the beds, did not think we were going to see that in our country. And yet that's what's happening, driven largely by the large number of unvaccinated people.
So later today, we expect President Biden to talk about a new strategy for combating COVID, right? What are you hoping to hear? Like, how do you think the strategy should change?
Yeah, so, you know, we know what we need to do to get this pandemic under control and to put it behind us. And I'm hoping to hear President Biden come down strongly on those things.
The vaccines work. They are safe and effective. They are the best tool by far that we have to prevent people from getting sick and certainly to prevent people going into the hospital.
We need to get a lot more people vaccinated. So we've started with vaccine mandates. I expect and hope that there will be stronger efforts to get people vaccinated. We need to have a strategy for schools. Every school district on its own is figuring out how to get kids back safely. You know, thousands of kids are getting hospitalized every week.
11-year-old Levi Quartucci was back in school barely a week when he tested positive for COVID-19. It's unclear where and how he picked it up, but he spent 4 days fighting it off in a hospital bed.
It just felt horrible throughout the whole time.
We have got to come up with a strategy for protecting kids. I want to see activity on schools. The one area where I feel like the Biden administration really has not done enough is on testing and ramping up testing and testing availability. So I would love to see a very, very strong plan on testing. That's got to be in there because it's critically important to getting this pandemic under control.
What do you mean testing? Like, what's wrong with the testing situation right now? You think you got COVID? Go get a test somewhere.
Yeah, what we need to be doing is we need to have cheap, fast tests, rapid antigen tests, widely available. They should be getting used in schools, in workplaces, in universities.
We're seeing an increasing number of people who need to get COVID tested due to signs and symptoms of COVID.
And they should be really quite readily available. If we had that, there's very good reason to believe that would keep infection numbers low. Because look, if you're going into the office and you have a little bit of a sniffle, you may not go and get a test at a CVS. That's going to take time and cost money and take
all my drugstore lines wrapped around the block.
So what you can do is you can do a quick rapid test at home. 15 minutes, you get the result back. If it's positive, you stay home. If it's negative, you can go safely into the workplace. That kind of stuff can make a tremendous difference.
All of the kids in our school performed the quick test, the antigen test. They need to bring the test result to us in order to start the school year.
Countries like Germany, UK are using these things widely and doing a great job. We really just haven't done that.
All right, Dr. Ashish Jha, thank you so much.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Next up on Start Here, September 11th led to war with some countries, so why are the Saudis still our buddies? Our series on 9/11 continues after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
As we build toward the 20th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, you got so many families who were affected, right? Some lost family members to the attacks themselves in the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the United Airlines aircraft that was heroically brought down by those on board. But you've also got first responders who survived the trauma, people who had health trouble over the years because they lived near Ground Zero, family members of service members who were killed in the resulting wars. And when you haven't gotten the results you were promised or the answers you deserve, 20 years is not going to fix that. There are still causes to be championed all these years later.
Families who lost loved ones on 9/11 will be moving forward with a lawsuit.
We have been fighting for this for over a decade, for justice for the murder of our loved ones.
We're being stonewalled by the FBI, the DOJ, the Department of Defense.
My son was murdered. I want to find out who murdered him. I want to find out who helped murder him.
And so today, in our ongoing series this week, looking back on the events of 9/11, I want to talk to somebody who knows what it's like to fight for answers for 20 years, because he might have just gotten some. We're joined now by Brett Eagleson, whose father actually perished in the Twin Towers when he was trying to help first responders to pass out two-way radios, getting other people out. And Brett, you've told me before, you were 15 years old at the time, you were in high school, and so often I feel like the narrative that's kind of assigned to families is, you know, it was tragic, there was nothing anyone could do, we're just trying to remember our loved ones and we're trying to move on. That has not been your narrative, right? You've really been on a mission.
Yeah, and very early on, you know, after 9/11 happened, my family, myself, we weren't really focused on the whys. We were focused on just piecing our lives back together. And I was trying to be or have as normal of a high school experience as I could. I was trying to be a normal, regular, everyday teenager. And I was focused on friends and doing well in school and getting into college and just kind of ignoring it.
This report represents the unanimous conclusion of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States.
Also very early on, I don't think many of us really believed the narrative that our government told us, that 19 hijackers somehow banded together and pulled off the most consequential and devastating attack on American soil in the history of this country with no help from anyone.
We have found no evidence of the involvement of the Saudi government in the plot.
And all the evidence has always pointed to Saudi Arabia to begin with.
In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, we learned of the 19 hijackers, 15 of them were from Saudi Arabia.
We have found evidence of individual Saudis and Saudi charities.
Many of the charities early on that were found to be funneling money to Al-Qaeda were Saudi-funded and Saudi government-run charities.
Whether witting or unwitting, we do not know.
The Crown Prince has been very strong in condemning the murder of U.S. citizens.
We've always thought as family members, well, where there's smoke, there's probably fire. And it's really important to get the truth out there and to learn everything that our government knows.
We are at war, and this is the battlefield. And we are the group that's going to go out and find the enemy and find who's financing the enemy.
Well, and so you guys start this lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, right? Essentially alleging that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the actual government there, was somehow complicit in these attacks. The Saudis have denied that, of course. The 9/11 Commission did not find that the Saudis were responsible, but those same commissioners said, you know, we were rushed, we were hurried, and only after that did the FBI do some of its own investigating. That's the stuff you guys wanted to get your hands on, but for years you said, you know, from President Obama to President Trump to President Biden, no one was letting you view these documents that might corroborate your suspicions, and yet now there's suddenly been movement on that too.
Well, I think first and foremost, it just goes to show you that we were right all along. Our government has now publicly acknowledged, yes, there are files that our FBI has, and the files are related to Saudi Arabia.
President Biden has signed an executive order for the declassification of documents related to the 9/11 attacks.
It states information should not remain classified when the public interest in disclosure outweighs any damage to the national security.
One, I think that we're vindicated in the sense that our government is acknowledging, yes, we've had these files for a long time. Yes, we've been keeping them from you. So I think that's one in and of itself is a victory. But two, the 9/11 families are cautiously optimistic. We've never had a president of the United States engage in such a personal level. We've never had an executive order from a president. We've never had a president publicly acknowledge the fight that we've been through and the struggle that we've been through. But the 9/11 families have been beaten up for 20 years by our own government.
The president vetoed a bill allowing 9/11 families to sue Saudi Arabia in U.S. courts.
There is an alternative mechanism for us to resolve these kinds of issues with other countries. That's the essence of diplomacy.
We had our law JASTA vetoed by President Obama. That was really disheartening for a lot of us. It didn't feel good. It felt really bad. Like, why would Obama not take our side? Why would he protect the Saudis?
We have a very strong ally in Saudi Arabia.
Then we had President Trump look us in the eye, me personally, and say that we were winning, that he's going to hit them hard, and that the documents were coming. Lo and behold, to find out less than 24 hours later, his Attorney General, William Barr, invoked the state secrets privilege.
Very importantly, they're investing billions of dollars. They're buying their equipment from us. And remember this, they don't have to buy it from us. They can buy it from Russia and they can buy it from China.
I think we are cautiously optimistic, but we're clear-eyed and we have our guard up.
What sort of stuff are you hoping to find?
We hope that these documents come in the form of being unredacted. You know, my biggest fear, our biggest fear is that the first document production that's due is on 9/11 itself, and we get sort of a sterilized, cherry-picked handful set of documents that are heavily redacted. That's certainly not a win for us. We need these documents so that we can use them, so that we can prove that our government and that our government knew and that the Saudis were involved. So I think the proof is going to be in the pudding, but I want to give credit where credit is due. President Biden stepped up in a major way.
You guys had said don't bother showing up to 9/11 events unless you do this. Do you think he stepped up to that level?
I think so. I mean, but again, it remains to be seen what is actually produced. So far, as of today, we don't have any documents in hand. We don't know what's coming. And to be clear, the executive order does not mandate the release of the documents. The executive order mandates the review of the documents. Our government can still, I think our biggest fear is that our government or the executive branch and the FBI just want to get to 9/12 and 9/13 when the attention of the world is now on something new, and then they don't produce anything, or they produce sterilized documents.
So then I got to add, this probably sounds like a stupid question to you, but I still have to ask it. Why does it matter to you now, 20 years later, so much that Saudi Arabia be held so publicly responsible? Like, I get why the government might say, you know, we don't want to imperil our relationship with this other country. Why is it so important to you that that be a defining factor in a relationship between these countries?
Well, I think that there's a number of reasons, and the most obvious is that we need to get the history right. And history is being written as we speak, and it's my goal, and it's a lot of others' goals, that when our kids grow up and when they teach the subject of 9/11 in public schools, that it's known, that it's widely known, that it's kind of household knowledge that 9/11 wouldn't have been successful were it not for the Saudi support network that was in place in the United States prior to 9/11. And it's important for the Saudis to be held accountable in the sense that other countries or other supporters of terrorism need to know that they will be ultimately held accountable.
Why are we standing here today, adversaries to the FBI and Department of Justice, instead of allies?
They have a historic opportunity to finally do the right thing that previous administrations before them failed to do, and that's stand with its American citizens before the interests of Saudi Arabia.
I'm not naive enough to think that if this information comes out, we're going to cut off relationships with the Saudis or we're going to go to war with the Saudis. Definitely not advocating that. Definitely not a fan of more war. But I think that it needs to be stated for the record that we recognize there were bad elements within the government of Saudi Arabia that contributed to the success of 9/11. And it was Saudi negligence, possibly Saudi Arabia knowing that something bad was going to happen and that they were directing money to these bad actors. So I think that that's important, is that they now need to know that the United States will ultimately hold you accountable if you're found to be supporting terrorism that kill Americans on American soil.
All right, Brett Eagleson, son of Bruce Eagleson, on what's obviously going to be such an impactful week and big developments here just within the last several days. Thanks so much for the time, Brett.
Thank you.
Last week, we told you about one of the biggest trials of the year.
She was billed as the next Steve Jobs.
The fraud trial of the founder of the blood testing company Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes.
Ambition and fame gone terribly wrong.
Some of you might listen to the ABC News podcast about Holmes. It's called The Dropout. And if you haven't listened yet, you really should. And yesterday, we got some brand new developments on this case. So we brought in, who else? The host of The Dropout, ABC's chief business correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis. Rebecca, you were in the courtroom, right? Did you get a sense of how big this case has become?
Well, Brad, even before you enter the courtroom, you can feel it because the line just to get inside was more than a block long. In fact, one of the people I spoke to in line was just a student who lives in the Stanford area and wanted to come and have a look for herself. There were some high school students from a local school that showed up to see the trial, and even the Stanford student newspaper was here to cover it because, of course, the dropout is someone who went to Stanford for a few semesters.
Well, and so sitting there in the courtroom, listening to these opening statements, did you get a sense of, you know, what case is going to be laid out here by both sides?
Well, Brad, it's really interesting. In opening statements, each team really lays out their vision for this trial. And the government laid out a vision where they will say that Elizabeth Holmes misled and created and committed fraud throughout much of her career running Theranos. And they looked at it from the standpoint of the device itself.
And how many tests could it run at that time in 2010?
Which many people will recall is this device that the company promised could run hundreds of tests on a few drops of blood.
I don't know exactly what the number was. I think just from the development reports that I've seen that there was probably tens of tests. I mean, we got up to about somewhere between 70 to 90 immunochemistries.
The government said at the very best, this testing device could run 12 tests in the very best moments. But for the most part, there were things that the company said over and over, that Elizabeth Holmes herself said over and over, that it was, for example, used on the battlefield in military helicopters, that just never were the case.
The prosecution is going to point very heavily to the statement she made, that this is not just puffery. This was someone who, even if she was in some form of an abusive relationship, that it didn't actually affect her intent.
And they also talked about the pharmaceutical companies, names like Pfizer, Shearing Plough, that looked at Theranos over the years and decided to pass on using the technology. And they said that we will be hearing from those companies, including Walgreens, which was the one place where there were Theranos wellness centers inside of their stores for a span of time. This is where customers, patients actually came in contact with Theranos. The defense, on the other hand, made an argument that sounded much more similar to the rise of Elizabeth Holmes. Many of the things that people, if they followed this story, heard in 2014 and 2015 are the things that were inside of the defense's opening statement.
She just needs one person to fall in love with her, like so many have, and say, stop, don't persecute this young, pretty woman who's a mother. That's the hope.
She was ambitious. She wanted to do something powerful and revolutionary, but mistakes were made along the way.
All right, and Holmes has pleaded not guilty. Her team says bad test results don't equal fraud, but Rebecca, I think we hear so much about the companies and the shareholders and the venture capitalists. It's easy to forget that when you get a blood test that's allegedly incorrect, there is real damage that can arise out of that, right? Like, how much is that going to be at the forefront of this? Or is it all just allegations of business fraud? That's it.
Well, it's a really important point because there are two pieces to this fraud. On the one hand, there's the investor fraud, and on the other hand, it's the misleading of doctors and patients, according to the government's case. And the government said, we will be hearing from a number of people who got inaccurate results from Theranos tests, women who thought they were pregnant or not pregnant based on inaccurate results, a woman whose medication was changed because she thought she had miscarried when in actuality she had not because of an inaccurate test. And we've heard from people who thought they had breast cancer when in actuality they didn't.
What would you say to the jury if you were sitting in front of them right now?
I think what I would say is consider for a moment the relationships that you have and how important it is for people to be treated fairly without having to worry someone may be defrauding them. Because that's exactly what happened in my case.
And so those patients are people that this jury will hear from. And just in watching the body language and the behavior of the jurors, at least in the first days of this trial, it feels like they will be more compelled by the arguments relating to real people, those patients and doctors, as opposed to investors who were putting millions of dollars in and, as the defense will say, should have known better.
All right. Rebecca Jarvis, I can hear behind you what a zoo this trial has become. So thank you so much for stepping out and taking some time.
Thanks. Bye-bye, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, your boss doesn't know you're not wearing pants. Or do they? One Last Thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. If you've been working from home during the pandemic, what do you think your boss knows about you at this point?
That's been a real problem.
Sure, they've seen your pet on Zoom. They know your roommate seems to hold conference calls at the worst possible times. But do they also know what website you're on right now, or when you're swinging out of the house to do errands? Increasingly, bosses are using programs known as Tattleware, services that monitor and in some cases even photograph employees throughout their day. Take the program that's literally called Sneak. Companies sometimes require that their employees have this on their computer, which then gives bosses the ability to see what their workers are doing at any moment. With one click, your boss could start a video conference with you.
Can you hear me, Judge?
I can hear you. I think it's a filter.
Throughout the day, candid pictures of you are posted on a communal wallpaper for your coworkers to see, even if you're caught picking your nose.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
The rationale is, if you want this to be like The Office, well, your boss can walk by your cubicle any minute. Your colleagues should still be able to see you. Stay professional. Stay productive. But for many employees, this is reaching new levels of creepiness.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
If you have a computer assigned to you by your company, or if you've signed up for one of these programs, your boss can theoretically log your keystrokes. They can set up alerts whenever you type the word salary or resume in case you're searching for greener pastures.
Did you see the memo about this?
Sometimes employees are barely warned about this. It's just kind of implied in the company rules about work computers being for work only.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great.
Tattleware is not necessarily new. What's new is the number of bosses relying on it, with services like ActiveTrack, Hubstaff, and Time Doctor bragging about exponential growth in the last year. And in many cases, this is being presented to employees as a trade-off for the perks of working from home. The thinking being, if I get to lose my commute and keep the flexibility, who am I to refuse? I'm officially petrified. So to all my bosses, any email you ever see from my account that mentions your name, that was actually written by my dog, Frank. He's a bad dog, terrible worker. You should fire him. Hey, more special coverage of September 11th coming your way ahead of this Saturday, including our friends at ABC Radio. We've got this hour-long special looking back at September 11th, 20 years later. You can find it by searching for ABC Radio Specials wherever you get your podcasts, or just listen to your local ABC Radio affiliates. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.